Because you're jumping back into the gap. I let the coach, it's either sideline, two on the side, three on the side. That's off the second cut. Lead the country in offensive rebound.
Hey, coach. Welcome to the Basketball Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Oliver. Let's share the game. Before we get started with this week's podcast, I wanted to let you know that access is now open to the Basketball Immersion Platinum Collective Mastermind. This is an exclusive private next level coaching development program for a very specific coach. Go to basketballimmersion.com/platinum to learn more. Coaches, you'll be excited today to listen and learn from Craig Peterson. Craig Peterson is a Canadian basketball coach who's been the head basketball coach of the Icelandic men's national basketball team since 2014. Where he coached them at EuroBasket 2015 and EuroBasket 2017. And all in all, Coach, just awesome to have you here. And I know we're going to talk about some innovative things and some great topics to talk about as well. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I'm going to enjoy it.
Absolutely. I know you love basketball. I know you're well-versed in so many topics. But the one topic that I think we can really, really talk about here, which I think so many coaches can relate to, and that's competing with less talent, competing in some ways with an imperfect roster in the sense that most people don't understand. Iceland's only a country of, just over 300,000 people, right?
Yeah, I believe it's around 335,000.
Which is incredible to think that, you know, you're competitive at the EuroBasket level, which especially in the most recent 2017, I remember your team played some really great basketball and competed at a really high level. And you know, credit to you and the Icelandic organization for developing basketball. But, Coach, let's get into it. What are some of the challenges competing as the Icelandic men's national team as you compete against bigger and, in some cases, more talented teams?
Yeah, well, one of the things is, like you said, it's a small country. So there's a lot of talented players here, but the talent pool is maybe not as big as in some other countries. So, for example, when we're missing a player, it's not as easy to replace an injured or a player that can't make a window as it is for maybe some other countries. As well, we have a great new big guy in the program right now, Tryggvi, and he's developing at an unbelievable rate. But, you know, basically we have one of him where many other countries have, you know, maybe 10. So, but he's doing a great job. And like I said, he's improving rapidly and our style is starting to change and going over to using him more. And, you know, he's doing a great job.
Well, and he has a chance to be one of the best players in the history of the country, right? And doing some really good things in Europe in general and a unique player for you in the sense that you haven't had that within your era there, right?
No, we haven't. And you know, when I first started, the team was based on being undersized, switching stuff, doubling in the low post. And, you know, the real key to those teams the first 3-4 years was the chemistry. We had 4 or 5 guys that had been playing national team together for 15 years. So they knew each other. They knew the system well. The coach before me did Peter Ökvist from Sweden. He did a fantastic job of implementing a defensive system, which the players were able to more or less master, which gave us the opportunity to compete with some teams at, especially EuroBasket 2015, where we played 3 pretty tight games there.
We're going to talk about some of the offensive innovations and some of the different things that you brought to the program, but let's start with that switching defense. And I know you've moved away from it, but let's start with that. What were some of the techniques that you found valuable in that system that was in place and some of the things that maybe could help coaches in terms of the technical tactical when it comes to switching? Because I think a lot of high school coaches especially can relate to this in the sense that, you know, switching is an easier way. And I've always argued it's an easier way to play at some of those lower levels because you get to focus more on offense, which is harder to teach in some ways and harder to get good at. But it also just simplifies the whole thing, the whole scout, the whole thing. So what are some of the technical, tactical things?
Well, first of all, I have to say is when I started up here, I wasn't that knowledgeable about the details of switching. And luckily, my assistant at the time in Denmark was also the assistant coach up in Iceland. So he was very well schooled in the details of the switching. And because the players, some of them had played for the previous coach in Sweden, they also knew the details much better than I did. So I learned a lot in it. But one of the key things was that we tried to do was when teams had, for example, a side ball screen, is try and keep the ball on that side of the floor instead of letting it come across the top and be moved easily. Another thing we had to deal with in different situations was whether the guy switching was going to go over top of the screen or go underneath. And we ended up with having to be able to do both depending on what teams we were playing. A team like especially Poland, when we played them, when we went over the top of the initial screen, they just killed us with sealing our guard and being able to go kind of a high-low situation. So we had to quickly adjust and work on that to holding up the center and delaying the action. And, you know, there's a lot of small details that go into not only the switching, like we talked about briefly, but also the when and where to double team on the low post and how the rotations are going to happen and how you're going to switch out on the backside. And there's many, many, many small details, you know, as opposed to some people switching and just telling their players, well, just switch. If you're playing a good team, if you just switch without doing the details properly, then they're gonna find holes in it.
Well, and I'm curious because we've been a big switching team. So we've always tried to force when the ball comes off the ball screen, exactly what you're saying. Like if it does come off, we're always trying to force it back where it came and not let it turn the corner. And I don't see that emphasis as much from some coaches. And I think that's the biggest problem they get into is that the whole point of the switch is to obviously deny access. And that's a big part of it. So I'm glad you touched on that a little bit.
Yeah. And another thing it could be is our you know, so-called five man who was very undersized, he was very mobile and very strong. So he was able to get out quick on those and be able to contain the ball. Whereas if people are doing it with not as mobile player, then perhaps good guards are able to get over the top of them and turn the corner, like you said. So we were lucky to have a player like Klinner Berenson who mastered that ability to get out and keep the ball on one side.
And have you got into much of the triple switching and some of the things like that to be able to, call it switch the up down and get players back to matchups? I mean, you talked about doubling and we'll get into that, but even before the double, talk about some of those ideas to get out of the problems.
Yeah, but we did triple switch. And again, the players were fantastic at picking it up. And when I first got here, you know, like I said, my assistant took most of the defensive stuff and I learned a lot in that triple switching. But the players were amazing at it. And they had experienced it a lot before also. So it was pretty easy for them to pick up.
It's not as well
at that time. When I first got here, our point guard was actually our tallest player, Pavin, and he's, you know, 6'7", 6'7" and a half. So to have a point guard out there who was maybe our best post defender as well was very good in the switching system. But over the years, now he's playing as our four man. So he's kind of like a point forward instead now, but a great basketball mind, and he's doing a great job for us this summer.
Well, I look forward to discussing that too. So the triple switching, I mean, number one, it's not as hard as you think, right? It's like anything. There's repetition and there's game situations that develop the ability to do it. And that's what you're talking about. But the other thing you brought up, which I think is really important to understand is, and people panic about a small on a big, but, and your point guard was tall, so it's a little different, but it's still very hard to post up a smaller player because that smaller player has the leverage. And they tend to get the benefit of the doubt more from officials, right? They're able to get away with more. And that's what we basically told our smaller players. And anytime in a bad matchup, it's just foul constantly.
Yeah. But another thing we try to emphasize is that, you know, when the ball handler is, you know, picks up the ball looking to get it in, then we got to try and smother the ball so they can't pick and choose where they pass or at least make it an easy pass. And that's also something that our center Klinner was very good at, you know, not getting beat, but when the ball was picked up, then he's going to get up on it and not make things easy for the passer. And that, like you talked about, not letting the ball get into the post easy and smothering the ball on the outside were two things that we adjusted at halftime when we beat Great Britain in Great Britain because they had been playing so well out of the low post, you know, so the adjustment we made was that we're not going to let it get in there as easily. Because they played a very good game that game, and especially in the first half, but we managed to get a little bit more control of it by doing those two things in the second half of that game.
So when you're talking about double teaming the post, so where are you coming from primarily in terms of that? Was it variable spots?
No, actually, when the first year we did it, it was solely from the baseline, always from the baseline. So when it does go into the post, we're getting on the top side. Like, of course, if the player is 15 feet from the hoop, then we wouldn't do it. But, you know, down in the low block, get on the top side and force them into a spin. And as soon as they go into that move, that the double teamer's got to be there.
And so,
adding to that, what we had to do in the years after was we had to also practice doubling from different spots because teams knew what we were going to do, and they more and more teams started to do it. And so we had to mix things up and come from the top sometimes just so that we could throw different looks at different teams.
Which is what I wanted to talk about a little bit, is what cued the decision to go double then? Was it a position on the floor? Was it the matchup? Did you sometimes not double certain matchups? What are some of the things that cued the decision to go?
Well, if they had a foot in the key, then it was automatic. Go. Don't wait for the dribble. But if they were just off the block and they'd start to make a move and our big guy would sort of jump on the high side, then that was a signal that the guard had to be there.
And it's great stuff because, again, I think what people hopefully are appreciating from this conversation is that you had to compete with an imperfect roster. And you talked about the size of your point guard being your biggest player. How tall was he?
He's a good 6'7".
Okay. And then from there, your positions varied, obviously, in terms of size. But what you tried to do is that you tried to space the floor and play. I said a little bit when I phrased it to you, playing a little bit compact to wide. Is that sometimes you'd start compact, but inevitably you always ended up in a spread or you played out a spread. But can you describe your offensive system a little bit to us that you have adapted? You adapted early on with this roster.
Yeah, early on. Well, first of all, I would say that when you say that we had an imperfect roster, I think that if we had the same size as other teams, but had, you know, the talent was less, then it would be even more to their advantage. The fact that we were smaller, it allowed us to, like you're getting into right away when I came in, we said we're going to move the ball through the five man because these big teams in Europe, they're probably not going to deny him. So if we can't go, you know, get the ball where we want easily, we're going to move it through the five man because that'll probably be the easiest way and we want some ball movement. So that was one way, but we also knew we didn't want to sort of play just on the perimeter. We didn't want to just play handball around the three-point line. So we also added an offense where it involved our guards posting up and playing out of the low post. And we put that all in already back in 2014. And then off of that, we got various calls and various sort of, you know, quick hitters and different alignments out of the basic sets. So, but yeah, like you said, we're trying to get movement. We're trying to get cutters. We had different options as to sometimes our four man would swing it. And if he did that, then when he swung it, we would automatically flare him with the five man. And you can see that in quite a few of the videos of highlights of when we play, especially in 2015 and 17, that we're our kind of undersized four man, Heiker Paulsen. He would receive flare screens at the top, and it's quite an effective way to get him shots.
And when you talked about flare screens, and I saw those on those clips, and I'll share the clips when we share the podcast, but did it matter who was setting the screen, or was it little bigs? Was it different things to create matchups out of it?
Yeah, but in our transition offense, it was always the five man. But we also had a half court set where we'd get a lot of action going, and it would be the point guard that set it, and then he would slip down the middle. And that was effective for us also, especially because we had so much movement before we set the flare screen.
And this intentional masking or movement before the final action, was that always a part of your philosophy, or is that something that you adapted a little bit more when you came to this roster?
No, I had been doing that kind of thing and playing with a kind of an undersized lineup also when I coached club team in Denmark. And that was primarily because, you know, the main team in Denmark back in Bears, they had Chris Christofferson, who was, you know, a 7'1 player who was, you know, built like a house. And we knew that we would never be able to find a player to match him. So we had to try and find players that would give him problems. So I always tried to get, you know, like a four-man to play kind of the five spot, or a five-man that could shoot so we could pull him away from the hoop to not only create good shots for the big guys, but also to create space under the hoop for our guards driving. So I've been used to running systems and plays for big guys and stuff moving the ball through the big guys for quite a few years before I came here.
Yeah, it's great. And what are some other lessons that you learned coaching the Icelandic team versus some of the powerhouses in Europe as you went through this process from, say, 2015 to 2017?
Well, I think one of the things, you know, just to say a little story, one of the things was in the preparation for Eurobasket 2015, we played a tournament in Poland, and the last game we played was against Belgium. And they had a very good team and a very athletic team. And in the last game of the preparation, they, other than the first two possessions, I don't think we got a clean look the whole game. They were switching everything and we couldn't get up a decent shot. And they beat us by 40. And, you know, I talked to the coach the next day and they had had a young player playing in the tournament who was very good, but he didn't play against us. And I asked the coach why. And he says, well, he just didn't fit against you guys. And I was like, okay, you're keeping your best player out against us because he doesn't fit. I mean, it was kind of funny. But my, you know, we had a slight worry that, you know, we'd really, really, really struggle at Eurobasket because of that last preparation game. But we quickly realized that the teams we were going to play in Berlin all usually played with two big heavy players on the court at the same time. So at least we would be able to move the ball and have you know, some speed advantage on the perimeter. So we weren't quite as worried about the switching defense that Belgium came at us with that summer as in Berlin, where, like I said, the teams were using two big players in the front court. I would say in 2017, things started to change where, for example, in 2015, Poland, they had these big heavy centers and their four-man was also a big shooter. But at Eurobasket 2017, that four-man was all of a sudden playing the five-man because so many teams had been going to having the five-man as shooters to pull others away from the hoop and kind of the style we were playing. But, you know, they were deeper and had more athletic players, so we struggled with that.
Yeah, interesting. And these lessons, I mean, and really what came through there a little bit in that messaging too, is that sometimes when we're coaching some of these different types of rosters, that we get so preoccupied with how are we going to compete with someone, when the reality is they have to adapt to you as much as you have to adapt to them. And sometimes you just double down on what you do and force them to adapt. And I think that's what the messaging is that came through for you, right?
Yeah, and we had to stick to what we believed that where we could, you know, we always have talked about up here is we want to try and create good shots. And yeah, but then if we're going to stay in games, then we got to make some of those shots. And that's a big reason why in Berlin we stayed with and had a good chance to beat Italy is because, for example, we created good shots, especially to start the game. And our first 15 points were 5 for 5 on threes. And it kind of got us going. But you know, when we played in Finland in 2017, you know, some of the teams like Slovenia, they were just so powerful. We played, you know, the score was even after the first quarter and then, you know, we're down 20 at halftime. It just went so fast. They're so talented. Their coach, I think he's amazing. The chemistry they play with, you know, the players they have, the way they ran their stuff, they really punished us. So, but impressive to, you know, it was a lot of afterwards we can look back and we got a lot out of playing against a team like that, but difficult to stop that machine.
So what's changed since you started in 2014 with this team? For you, having gone through all these experiences at Eurobasket and now preparing the team for another Eurobasket cycle, you just went through World Cup qualifying. What philosophically has changed for you in terms of how you envision this roster being able to compete moving forward?
Yeah, but like we've talked about a little bit before, is now we have this young big player, Tryggvi Hilmarsson, and he's developing at an extraordinary rate to the point where he's a legitimate threat on on offense in both our first qualification games just now against Switzerland and against Portugal. When he gets the ball, they're coming with double teams. Just a couple years ago, if he got the ball anywhere in the paint, they would just leave their point guard on him, you know, if they switched. But these teams having to double team him now is opening up different opportunities for us and giving guys, well, not Trigvi as well, but giving other guys opportunities off of teams having to double team him. So we're starting to use him more and more. The players are getting used to him more and more, trusting him more and more. And it's just changed. We've come from, you know, moving the ball through the big guy to wanting to have the big guy with the ball underneath. And in the past, that hasn't been the case because we've been so undersized in the post. So things are changing, but it's going rapidly and it's going quite well. And as well, we have Martin Hermansen, who's playing in Alba Berlin, who's also improving at an extraordinary rate just since February. I mean, he's improved so much. His for example, his defense has gone from being not very strong, to put it nicely, to he's clearly our best defensive player now. And as well, offensively, the passes he's making and the things he can see, he's setting other people up. He, of course, can score himself and create him shots for himself, but he's just improving at a rapid pace, and it's great to see.
And you talked about the changes defensively, and is that mainly because of the unique player that you now have? Is that the philosophy of why you moved away from switching?
Yeah, and we want to try and keep our five-man on the other team's five-man now so that we don't have to help as much. There are some situations where we're going to have to switch, and, you know, a team like Portugal, they quite often, when Trigvi is on the court, they'll have two four-men out there who can shoot. So they're going to pick and pop a lot. And, you know, we're working on solving that little problem or at least knowing when to read it properly. And, you know, like I said, we would rather keep Trigvi on the other team's big guy near the hoop so we don't have to help as much. Yeah, because teams have gotten so good at punishing double teaming in the low post. They know what they're doing now. It's not to, you know, we might have been one of the only teams doing it a few years ago, but now everybody knows how to beat it. And so, like I said, there are times when we do have to switch and teams do find the low post and we will still double team, but not nearly as often as a few years ago.
And I guess let's circle back a little bit. I mean, the country as a whole has invested more in sport, and that's one of the reasons we're seeing improvement in basketball, but we've seen improvement in soccer on the world stage is probably the most impactful thing that we've seen from Iceland. But how is this generation of players now different than the past generations? Have they had better coaching? Have they had better experiences? Are they just more focused on basketball? What philosophically has changed on that end?
A quick interruption of the podcast to remind you that coming up September 8th is our BI Academy one-day coaching clinic at Cal State Fullerton in the Los Angeles area. Go to www.basketballimmersion.com/clinics to register and learn more. Special for this clinic is that any coach that's registered as Basketball Immersion member can bring their staff or friends for just $75 per coach.
Well, I think that, you know, basketball has always been fairly big in Iceland. Like, the players are very passionate, but I think that I think the coaching has got better. I think it's gotten much better. The first of all, the players are dedicated to getting better. They spend a lot of time in the gym. They spend a lot of time in the gym in the off season, not just shooting, but doing a lot of different skill work and understanding of the game. I think the youth coaches here do a good job of teaching the players how to play. It's not all one-on-one. It's how to move without the ball and how to read defenses and how to cut at the right times. I think they do a nice job of that here. A very good job of that here. And like I said, I think the coaching has gotten much better. And you can see it at the elite level here. It's just much better. The change in the rule up here that just a couple years ago, you could only have one foreign player on the court at a time. So it was always four Icelandic players on the court. Now that they allow Bosman players, the league has gotten noticeably bigger because there's big Bosman players coming in. So it used to be a league where everybody switched everything. And now there's a lot of different defensive systems coming into play and the coaches know how to coach it. And, you know, it's given a, it makes the players better that they don't just switch stuff, but that they got to know the coverages and various other schemes as well.
So you talked about cutting and you've talked about it relative to how you guys play, and you talked about it relative to the development of players in general. What are some things that you've seen being done to help develop cutting, empowering the weak side, moving without the ball, whatever way you want to phrase it? Because that's such an important part of the modern game. We're going to have this space, then there's space to be cut into. And the teams that take advantage of that are definitely better on offense and more efficient. So can you talk about some of the things that you've seen?
Yeah, but some of the things, you know, with regard to cutting that, you know, we try to look at here, but as well as I try to teach the kids that I coach back in Denmark is the timing of the cut, of course, the change of pace in their cut, but also just as important is when you cut, you're usually going to, you know, maybe suck in another defender, and that other offensive player has got to react to that and move into the open space. And that's something that we try and emphasize, that cut is going to open up somebody else and that it's a very unselfish play. And who knows, maybe you get open, but if you don't, there's a good chance that it's opening somebody else up.
And are you developing that in small-sided games? Are you developing that in 5-on-5? Or are we doing drill-based work? How are we developing it?
Both. This week in practice, we're doing it a lot of out of 3-on-0 and 4-on-0 situations, just drilling it, different situations. Also putting some emphasis on it with kids in 4-on-4 games, 4-on-4 continuous games, where there's got to be a certain number of cuts and fill-ups before you're allowed to score and things like that. So that it becomes habit for them, and so that they can get used to the timing and also used to when not to cut. You know, there's a lot of kids that have a problem with cutting into the space where there's a pick and roll going on, and just trying to teach them when it's good to stand in space and when it's time to cut. So,
It's such a problem at youth levels of players cutting to action rather than spacing from action or even holding spots. So yeah. I totally relate to what you're saying, because I've seen it through a whole summer this summer of just, you know, when you put players in game situations, their immediate reaction is to cut to the ball off the ball. And it's clearly not to their benefit to do that, nor to the team's benefit. So is part of the mentality is teaching them that it's okay to stand. It's okay to
spot.
What are their attentional cues from there? Are they reading their defender if their defender turns the back? Are they reading the ball? Do you give them specific things?
Yeah, exactly. You know, I try and, you know, when your defender turns his head and can't see you, you can maybe cut if the time is right. There's like you mentioned, there's times where you got to stay in space and maybe just make small adjustments so the passer can make the clear pass to you in like a window. Just various things. And you know, of course, trying to teach it by stopping certain situations and explaining why the movement they just made was wrong, or in some cases right, of course, so they get a better understanding.
Coach, defending ball screens with now a big versus not a big, how has that changed for you in terms of, you know, what would be your primary or secondary ball screen defensive technique? Has that changed now?
Yeah, right now we're trying to keep everybody in behind the ball as opposed to coming out and hedging out to, you know, halfway out to half court just because teams are so effective. We're trying to keep things a little bit tight. And so we're kind of trying to high contain and stunt in from the other side and let the big guy fall back to their big guy if he's a roller. And if he pops out then and there's nobody on the backside, then we're going to switch the guard out to him if the big guy gets stuck too far away. So there's, we have some other stuff too that we have in our kind of defensive playbook in case we're having problems with something that we can pop over to something else and then maybe go back just to break things up a bit. Once in a while, we will go matchup zone. So we're in zone and at some point in the other team's offense, we'll go back man. And, you know, we kind of did that last week in Portugal, and I wouldn't say we stopped them from scoring, but it broke up the rhythm a little bit. we think, because when we did go back to man, they basically went scoreless for 5 minutes. And I don't know if that's why, but that's what happened in the game. So,
well, and and that's the reality. I mean, somehow, some way, you've got to make the defense a little bit, or make the offense a little bit dizzy with some of the things that you do defensively. Yeah. And that's the challenge, and switching. And we've done that before where we've acted like we're in zone, and then really it's just one swing of the ball and we're in man, or if they go to a ball screen, we're immediately in man. And yeah. Again, it's a gimmick in a sense, but it's a smart one because it just, again, you're trying to change the rhythm, change in some cases what they run.
Yeah, and maybe just for a possession, you get some confusion going on. We also did that down in 2014. We were down in, you know, in our second qualifying game. We're in Bosnia, and we're down 21 going into the fourth. And we're like, okay, you know what? Our next game's against Great Britain. Let's put up a 1-3-1 zone so that they scout it, and then in the game we'll match up out of it. And next thing you know, we had three chances at tying the game. They all of a sudden missed all their shots, and we're like, what a great zone. And then we looked at the video after, and no, it wasn't a great zone. Their best shooters just missed shots. I mean, it was, the zone sucked actually, but we luckily, they didn't make shots, and we got every rebound, and we got going on offense, and it changed the game around. And maybe just that change in flow or change in look caused a little bit of confusion or different looks, and we got ourselves back in the game. So that was a strange move, actually.
Well, and it comes back to evaluation a little bit. How do we deem what we're doing successful? Is it just based on results, or is it based on, again, like you can make the right decision on offense and still miss the shot?
Right.
And you could completely screw up things on defense and they can miss the shot. So yeah, that comes back to evaluation.
And that's like I said, we were thinking, oh, our zone is so great and everything. And then we look at the video and we're like, it was terrible. They just got wide open shot after wide open shot, but they missed them, you know. So
great coaching. It's great coaching, Coach. We always come back to that, don't we?
Well,
No, I know it well. I know those feelings well. And that's pretty, it's part of this whole process, which is evaluation. And what things have been in place since 2014 or that you have put in place to be able to help you evaluate the progress of the program, along with obviously the Icelandic Federation and everything else? And, you know, you're a long tenured national team coach, which, as you know, is rare, which is a testament to the success you've had and obviously the commitment from the Icelandic Federation to keep some consistency to it. So what are some things in place to be able to help with the evaluation moving forward?
Well, yeah, but after Eurobasket 2015, we had some up-and-coming players in the States. I went over to visit them. So talking to their coaches and seeing how they're doing. Of course, always keeping an eye on the players here. And then what we've done here is actually a little bit along the lines that they did in Canada back when I was trying out for the national team in the late 80s. That was, we invited almost everybody to some kind of a tryout here. And it was kind of along the lines of, hey, you can't say you didn't get to show something, you know. And so we invited big groups of players, especially players who had showed something, to maybe show them how we were doing things, give them some inspiration, play against the best players during the summer for a week or however long we had them in. And that was really great at the start. But now that we've gone over to these windows, there's not really time for it. You know, we have a couple of days to get prepared for a game. There's not time to bring in 45 guys to take a look. So unfortunately, that's kind of gone to the side, but Iceland has been good at been going to these small nations games that are every couple of years in May. And we basically send a couple of our better under 20 players and sort of the not the main group of national team guys, but the next guys, and get them some international experience that way and be able to evaluate them against other international players. And that's been something that's been very good for us. As well, the Iceland has been very good at sending, you know, all their teams to the, you know, the European Championships for youth teams, and including the under 20 team, which again, it gives us a great opportunity to see how the players are developing and how they play against other countries. Perhaps also a good indication of where we may be lacking in some areas that need to be picked up on. So the last thing I'll say is they've hired, you know, one of my assistants right now, Finnur Stefansson. He's in charge of the youth program, and he's put together a lot of things, stepping stones for youth players that they got to be able to do at different age levels, and different ways of monitoring national team players. And I think it's already shown some good signs, and I think it will only get better and only help Icelandic basketball in the future.
Are there academies in place for the better players, better youth players that they train centrally, or are they primarily at individual clubs? What's happening?
Yeah, but it's individual clubs.
Yeah.
It's individual clubs. Yeah. So there's no, you know, youth academies here or specialized teams or talent centers. Yeah. But that are the potential national team players. They get together a couple times a year, but it's not like, you know, on a weekly basis or anything like that, or a couple times a week, not at all. So it's all in the clubs.
Well, and what you've talked about in this philosophy is that there's inclusion, regardless of it being individual clubs, that everyone, I would assume for the most part, feels included, since that's seems to be part of the philosophy.
Yeah.
That's so great. Yeah. It's a great model for people that run clubs or AAU programs or whatnot to obviously make people feel included, but real or not, the opportunities, at least they feel like there's some inclusion. So, Coach, when we're talking about your offensive system, and again, a lot of really cool plays, and we'll share that, but when you develop those, are you looking at your players first and determining from them what we should be doing, or is part of it this overriding philosophy of saying, hey, listen, this has worked in the past, this will work again? What are some of the things that lead?
I guess it's a bit of a mix. It's a bit of a mix. Of course, it's got to, you know, fit to the players we have or the players that we're going to have on the court for a particular set. I love looking at plays from other coaches and other teams and looking at them, sometimes not to run them exactly the same, but some kind of an action that can maybe fit into what we're already doing, or something that can be used with the players we have, and maybe taking ideas from other places and twisting them a little bit. Sometimes some of the things we run just comes from scouting to see how teams are playing defense and seeing if within what we're doing, we can come up with a little twist to counter those things. So that there's there's lots of ways to get new plays or new little twists. And and my assistants are great at looking at new stuff. And when they run across something good, they send it to me and we talk about it. And of course, a lot of times it doesn't get used because the windows are so short, we can't put in everything. That's one of the things that we've done in the past. We've had a two-game window, but had a playbook big enough to play a whole NBA season. And of course, you're not going to use that much in a two-game window. So we're trying to, you know, cut down a little bit on our playbook when we have such a short period of time to prepare.
And for coaches that don't understand completely, the FIBA windows is basically this qualification for, in this example, the World Cup this year, and that at different points during the season, clubs and pro teams would stop for this FIBA window of qualification games. And it created challenges for basically every program in the world. Rosters varied. Definitely some of the best players didn't play, especially their NBA players, et cetera, mm-hmm. et cetera. But you did mention one positive from it, and that's that you thought that it generated more conversation, that it engaged people more in the process. Is that right?
Yeah. With regard to the national teams, now basically there's national team stuff coming up all year round. Like, so we're in the summer now. There was supposed to be some games in November, but they got moved, and then there's February, and then, you know, it's just, of course there's the World Cup in September. So throughout the year, there could be basketball conversations about how players are doing and who's available and all that. But yeah, it's different than just playing in the summer. Definitely it's different. There's sometimes the players get released from their club on a Monday, which is fine. So they don't get there, you know, to practice till Tuesday, and we're playing Thursday. So basically it's one day and a walkthrough and that's it. So luckily I've been involved with a lot of players who have played here for so many years. They pick things up so fast and they're on the same page so fast. It's just made things, you know, much easier than I could imagine it would be for a team that's not as experienced together.
When I've mentioned this before to coaches, that one of the things that I valued from a really short prep time, like when we got ready for Division I games in August, you know, where we had 3 or 4 days to get ready to play a Division I team on a foreign tour, that we got right to the point. And I found it actually made us better. And that's part of what's evolved my philosophy of get rid of the fluff, get right to the point.
Yeah.
It just helps you get better. And I think that's what I've heard a lot from a lot of coaches about these FIBA windows.
Yeah, and that's true. I mean, there's been a lot of times where we don't got time to break down these drills and work on this or that. Here's the play, run it, boom, go. And of course, back when we were double team, we had to spend some time on that because it takes a little bit of timing. But especially, like you said, offensively, you know, here's the play, go. We'll try and correct it as we're going and do the best we can. And we've also had some very good games on minimal preparation as well. But I mean, like I said, I think it's a big credit to the players for their years and years of dedication. It builds a certain chemistry and it builds a knowledge of one of another. And that has helped us tremendously.
Coach, as we approach the World Cup, maybe you can provide us a little bit of insight on a few teams that you've seen and that we should look for, not in terms of the individual talent, but maybe in terms of the style. Because I know I get asked all the time about what team should I watch? What team should I watch? And I'm like, well, let's ask someone that's coached and prepared for some of these teams that are playing in the World Cup. What are some of the things that we should watch for from some of the teams that you have a little bit more knowledge of?
Well, the first two that... other than the obvious of watching the American team, just because they're so talented and athletic, the two teams that come to mind are, you know, Spain and Serbia. I just think that their players are so smart and they're so just with everything, with their reading of the game and their, like we talked about before, their spacing and their understanding. I've been, you know, it's been great experience to be able to see those teams live, not only coaching against them, but watch them play other teams and just see how the players, their understanding on the court, off the ball, and so many different things. It's just, it's so impressive to watch for me. Those are two of the teams that I've always liked to watch and can learn from. Then it will, I think... I don't know which are the strongest teams, but I think some of the teams from Africa have been doing some good things here in the preseason, and they're athletic and they have very good players. It will be interesting to see how they do.
Are there some popular offensive actions that are different from the past that you're seeing more and more of from teams, or are there certain types of trends that you're seeing that are a little bit different than in the past that coaches can maybe geek out on technically and tactically during the World Cup?
You know what? I'm not so sure about that with regard to the World Cup. I haven't seen any of those teams play this summer in preparation, but I know that this has happened to us a lot with our big guy, is that a lot of teams, like Bulgaria did a good job of it, and Portugal has done a good job of it. When he's on the court, they use 2 4-man shooters. So they're always picking and popping and keeping him out, out of the paint and, you know, creating some confusion for us, not just the typical role 5-man, but now they're using a 4-man instead and popping him out. And, you know, I don't know if teams at the World Cup will try and do that to some of the bigger centers there, go at them with 2 4-men just to create different kind of opportunities. But that's something that we have seen teams do to us and something that has created problems for us.
Yeah, it's neat. And, it's everyone trying to figure out a way to counter someone else's strengths.
Exactly.
Obviously cover your weaknesses. So what was your counter to that?
Well, one of the things we're trying to do now is just when we see the guy, you know, pop out instead of roll, is just send the guard with him and then have Trigvi on their guard and try and send him to towards the other pack of players, so to speak, so that he can get some help with the guard. So it's just a matter of working on the timing and when does the guard leave and things like that. Or if the other guys are helping on the guard, can the big guy get back and things like that.
Well, it's the amazing. That's the tactical battle of putting your offense against someone's defense and vice versa. That makes it so fun in terms of coaching and all those other things. So what's up next for you in terms of your summer and I guess the end of the summer into the fall and your development and the development of the Icelandic national team?
Well, we're right in the middle of our pre-qualification for the qualification groups of Eurobasket 2021. So we lost by one in Portugal last week, and then we beat Switzerland the other day by one. Both games went right down to the buzzer. So now we have Portugal at home on Saturday, and then we have Switzerland next Wednesday in Switzerland. And it's a close group. Each team is 1-1 right now. And yeah, only one team moves on, and it's exciting and it's also nerve-wracking. But it's a lot of fun and I enjoy it a lot. In the fall here, there's no national team activities, but there will be activities again in February with either playing for qualification to Eurobasket or the lesser groups. I'm not sure what they're called right now, but the maybe they're pre World Cup qualifying for the next World Cup. I'm not sure, so we'll have to see. So, yeah.
Well, so many fun things on the horizon, and we appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule as you're getting ready to play some more games, I know, this week. So thank you for that, Coach, and thank you for all your sharing, and we look forward to following more of Icelandic basketball as it moves forward.
Great. Thank you.
To find out more about Coach and all we spoke about today, please take a look at the show notes for today's episode. I love to share the game and have basketball coaching conversations, so connect with me on social media. You can find all my social media information and all your membership, clinic, and consulting needs at basketballimmersion.com. That concludes today's episode. I know there are so many podcasts out there. Thank you for taking the time to listen to the Basketball Podcast with me, your host, Chris Oliver. Please subscribe and share the podcast with your friends and colleagues so that we can keep bringing you the best of what's out there and share the game.